associated, a system is associated with a state in the Hilbert space. And now the question is, if we have two such systems, each of which has its own Hilbert space, so our systems are A and B, how do we describe the composite system? Or put another way, what is the Hilbert space associated with the joint, with states of the joint system, the joint states of the joint system? How many of you know the answer to this already? You? Sorry? How many of you know the answer already? So I was just repeating that for, I already saw you guys. All right, good. Okay, so so the answer is, HAB, which is the Hilbert space of the joint system, is defined by the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. Okay, how many of you have seen the tensor product before? Oh, good share of you. Okay, good. How many of you feel like the tensor product is uniquely a quantum mechanical, is a non-classical way to describe composite systems? Oh, very interesting.
Ask the reverse question, though.
Which is?
Well, I mean, because I think you were just not putting your hands up.
Oh, what's the reverse question? I don't know how to state it, reverse question. So how many of you can tell me a classical analog of the tensor product?
The Cartesian product?
No.
No.
Any guess? Did you ever... Did you want to?
I was going to say the same thing, but isn't the configuration space of a composite classical system the Cartesian product of?
That is correct. It is. The Cartesian product is the is a composition rule, right? Classically.
That's what I meant.
But it's not analogous to this, right?
Well, it's totally different.
It's totally different. But is there a classical? So is there a better classical analog for this?
You mean like an analog of the construction, not of the motivation for the?
Well, actually, it is both. So, okay, so great. So we'll get into that. But so, okay, what do you guys want first? Do you first want to see where the tensor product structure comes from, which is discussed nowhere? Or do you want to just go through the formal description and then get the explanation afterwards? The
explanation first.
Explanation first. Okay. That's the harder way to do it, but okay.
Oh, in that case, it's the same.
You know what, you can just share my personal journey and I'll give you the tensor product structure of quantum mechanics and then we'll get the resolution afterwards, okay? So, okay, anyways, it's more important that you understand mathematically what's happening first of all. So here's how we're gonna do this. The idea is that, okay, so what is this? What is this product? Okay, so let's consider HA and define an orthonormal basis for HA. Which we'll just stick with my notation for my notes so I don't mix it up. Let's call it A sub K. So here we're going to let the index k run from 1 to m, okay, which of course then implies that the dimension of HA is m. And And of course, orthonormality tells us that AK prime is equal to delta K, K prime. It's an orthonormal basis. And we're going to do the same for HB. Similarly, HB is spanned by the orthonormal basis BL. So the dimension of HB is, where L goes from 1 to n. So the dimension of HB is going to be n. Then we can write it as follows. We can say HA is equal to CM. So that what this means is it's a n-dimensional complex vector space. And HB is equal to CN, which is an n-dimensional complex vector space. And HAB, which we stated as HA tensor HB, is equal to the Hilbert space CM tensor CN, which is equivalent to CM times N. So this means that the dimension of HAB is M times N. And we already have a spanning set. And HAB is spanned by the orthonormal basis AK tensor BL, where K, as before, goes from 1 to M, and L goes from 1 to N. So now, often you'll see the tensor product suppressed in the notation. Okay, so let's move over here. Often, the tensor product notation is suppressed. So we would write AK, BL, which stands for AK BL, which stands for AK tensor BL. So these are all different notations you will see. And the orthonormality is, as you would expect, AK prime BL prime AK BL is equal to AK prime AK times. Now remember that this inner product is a scalar, so this is just regular multiplication, BL prime BL, and that we have delta K K prime delta L L prime. Similarly, for N6, systems. We have H total, the total Hilbert space of N systems, each with Hilbert space H, we call it H sub I, with I going from 1 to N. Going to be H1 tensor, H2 tensor, dot, 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 Hn. And so this would represent things like I have a single particle in one dimension. If I allow the particle to explore two dimensions, then I add another Hilbert space. The particle can explore three dimensions, I add another Hilbert space. Then if I want to add the spin of the particle to the picture, I add a fourth Hilbert space for the spin degree of freedom. Okay. Similarly, if you have a condensed matter system consisting of n spin half particles, or a quantum computer consisting of n spin half particles, then you would have an n-fold tensor product of the spin half Hilbert space. So let me give that as an explicit example. E.g., a system composed of n spin half particles then each Hi is equal to a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and H total, or composite, or joint, is equal to C2 tensor C2 tensor C2, where there are an n-fold product and this is equivalent to the Hilbert space C2 to the n. Okay, so this is 2 to the power n. So we say that the Hilbert space grows exponentially with the number of subsystems here, where here with the exponential growth is the dimension. So to be explicit about that, so here the dimension of H total is equal to 2 to the n. So the Hilbert space dimension grows exponentially with the number of subsystems. This is often cited as a source of the power of quantum computing, but that's not true. And I'll give you a classical analog of this in a moment. Oh yeah, just some terminology. So we say so H equal to HA cross HB is called a bipartite system. Basically meaning it has two parts. And if we have H equal to HA, tensor HB, tensor HC, this is called, this is a tripartite system, and so on. And so on, or just in general, we say an n-partite system. We say n-partite for the case of having n subsystems, which is this case here. And then the second point of terminology is that given H equals HA tensor HB, we call HA and HB factor spaces. Of the total Hilbert space. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Well, I mean, you can write down.
Sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Now that I think about it, just wait a second, please.
You can write down like a Hilbert space arbitrary tensor product space by adding copies of C. So. You know what I mean? Like, I could write down H is equal to, you know, H tensor C tensor C tensor C tensor C.
Well, you mean just a single C1, you mean?
Yeah, C1, yeah. So, is there anything, like, I mean, obviously you wouldn't want to say that every Hilbert space is n-partite. So what's special about the system?
I don't know. I mean, you're picking at the terminology here, but I think that in some sense, the one-dimensional Hilbert space is completely trivial, just a complex number. We already know that all you're doing is you're adding that extra phase degree of freedom, that U1 freedom to the state. And yeah, I guess by convention, we ignore the one-dimensional Hilbert spaces because they're trivial in this notation.
And so I guess in a more general sense, like if you can, you know, you just take like H is, you know, C to the N, if you just factorize N, then you can get, you know, like you can write down a tensor decomposition of H. In general, would you say H is a n-partite system, and is that tensor decomposition, or is there?
No. I think you're getting at a tensor sum there rather than a tensor product. So if I have a three-dimensional Hilbert space for a spin one particle, okay, so I'll just say note. H equals C3 can be expressed as C1 plus C1 plus C1. And in this case, each of these C1s are a subspace, not a factor space.
I was thinking more like if H equals C8, that's C2 tensor, C2's tensor, C2.
If you have H equals C4, we can write this as C2 tensor C2, or we can write this as C2 plus C2. Well, I guess this is a bad example. Maybe 8 is a better example. Let me do it this way. Okay, 4 plus 4 is 8. 2 times 3, 2 to the third power is 8. Right, so the point is which Hilbert space is appropriate depends on the physical system you're describing.
Right, exactly.
Okay, and that's part of the physics that goes into this, not part of the math that goes into this.
So not every Hilbert space is isomorphic to C8 is tripartite.
Well, mathematically, these two spaces are isomorphic, but what's appropriate depends on the physics of the system. Now, what happens in like quantum computing and quantum information is you might have three physical spin half particles. And this is just this is a bit of an advanced comment, but I might have three spin half particles, but each one is subjected to some noise and decoherence, and so I'm losing my information very fast. What I can do is I can decompose this into a Hilbert space of this form. Although the physical system is analogous to this line, conceptually, I break the problem into this using control pulses, and I put my information in some subspace which is less sensitive to decoherence. So you can certainly use techniques that even though the physical structure is this, you exploit this mathematical structure for other reasons.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say that the physical structure is something, does that mean like the interaction terms are small between the different factors?
You mean for this subspace?
In general, someone hands you a Hamiltonian and then you say, oh, the physical, what underlies this physically is the C2 cross C2 cross C2.
Actually, that's a great question. And I can give you the gist of the answer, but really, I don't really know a way to give a complete answer. But the idea is you have to look at not the Hamiltonian per se, but rather you look at what are my controls on the system? What are the degrees of freedom I can manipulate? So that's what you have to think about. So if I have some physical system and you say it lives in a four-dimensional Hilbert space, and then I say, okay, well, I don't know which decomposition to use, you have to tell me more. And then you would say, okay, well, I have this four-dimensional Hilbert space because I have two spin half particles. Then I would say, aha, that means that these particles have some independence, right? So I can manipulate one particle in principle without affecting the other particle. That means that the one spin half particle is a factor space in this sense, and the other one is another factor space because I can control them independently. And so what that shows up as is the algebra of observables you're dealing with. So there you have two copies of SU2 at play. Now instead you might have answered differently. You might have said, no, this four-level system is the first four lowest lying energy states of an atom. Right? And then that's a different physical situation, and I no longer have the algebra, the natural algebra is not SU2 cross SU2 anymore. It's actually something different. It's a four-level system. And then it would just be C4 would be my natural Hilbert space. Now mathematically they're isomorphic, but physically, those are very different situations. In the case of a four-level system, I don't have some two-level factor space that I can control in some obvious way using the accessible, the degrees of freedom I have control over for manipulating the system. And so it's that kind of physics that you have to look at to understand what the appropriate decomposition is. And now there are other issues there where if you have what's called universal control of the system, that means you can implement any unitary from U4 on the space, then in a sense you break those barriers down and you can just think of the system any way you want now because you have the ability to interconvert this four-level atom into making it look like it's two spin-half systems. And in fact, that's the power of quantum information, is that if you have n spin-half particles in a Hilbert space of dimension 2 to the n, and you have universal control of that system, which means you can implement any unitary in SU 2 to the n, that means you can make that system look like anything you want. You can make it look like the 2 to the n lowest lying energy levels of an atom or whatever you choose. So there's a lot to unpack there, but that just maybe gives you a flavor of what's going on. Yeah.
Can we actually do that?
Yes, we can. Yes, so at IQC in the labs there, they have, your question is how big is N, right? So the current world record is around, 10 or 12 spin-half systems, which gives you a Hilbert space of, 2 to the 10, 2 to the 12, what is that? A few thousands? So a big, very big Hilbert space as people have demonstrated control over. The problem is being able to do this over a time scale that's interesting before the system gets wiped out by decoherence. And we'll get into that at the end of the course. I'll give some lectures on what the state of the art there is with quantum computing and so on. And the beauty of quantum information is really it's taken things. When we looked at quantum mechanics for describing, you know, mesoscopic systems and condensed matter systems, there you're describing things kind of in the aggregate. You're describing physical systems in an ensemble sense. And when you go to quantum information, you're looking at manipulating individual systems on the single shot level. And there you really see the full richness of quantum mechanics. And that's where some of the operational and conceptual subtleties become really important that maybe could have been ignored in the previous decades. Yeah?
So when people say that they've created an n-bit quantum computer, what they mean is they found like a 2 to the n-dimensional Hilbert space that they have universal control over?
Precisely.
Right, OK.
And qubit, that's a key distinction. OK, good. So C4 is a subspace. And in this picture, C2 is a factor space.
I don't want to drag this out, but in the factor space, you're able to naturally split it up into two different physical systems. Is there a way to naturally split things up into subsystems?
That is subsystems. You mean subspaces?
Subspaces.
Yeah, sure.
What's an example?
Okay, an example is if you have two spin half particles, you may remember this from your undergrad quantum mechanics. That four-dimensional Hilbert space of two particles can be divided up into the triplet and the singlet. And that's an example of dividing up that, and that's due to the symmetries of the problem. And there you have the three-dimensional subspace and the one-dimensional subspace. So that's how you would divide it up. So if you don't have that symmetry naturally, but you have universal control, you can enforce that symmetry so that under whatever dynamics, the system stays in each of those subspaces and they can be decoupled. OK, good. So before I take you through my personal journey and understanding where tensor product structure comes from, let me just do more of the formal mathematics to understand what the mathematical structure is here. Okay, so we're just going to consider the bipartite case, and then everything generalizes straightforwardly to the n-partite case. Okay, so we're going to consider some operator, let's call it C. I'm calling it O in my notes. Why am I changing this? I won't change it. Okay, we'll call it O. O is an operator that acts on, let's call this AB. So note, now O is an element of the linear operators on the total Hilbert space. Suppose O is equal to, O is of the form A tensor B. What this means is that A then is an element of the linear operators on HA, and B is an element of the linear operators on HB. I assume many of you are not used to this notation. I've defined it already, but just to be crystal clear about this, that means that A would take some state. So we'd have A psi equals phi, which means A takes psi to phi. And the key point here is that psi is an element of HA, and phi is also an element of HA. So A just acts on the Hilbert space HA, the factor space HA. OK, then if we have, we can have some state chi, which is an element of HAB. And let's suppose, or consider, let me say consider. Suppose chi, this is not necessary, but let's suppose chi has the form U cross V. Then we have U is an element of HA. V is an element of HB. Now, how do we do the usual tricks where we operate on these states with these operators using this tensor product symbol? Okay, so here are the formal properties now. We have alpha A tensor B U tensor V. What this means is, it means that A acts on the first, here we can put parentheses here, A acts on the first factor space and B acts on the second factor space. So we can think of this as alpha A acting on U. Okay, I'm just going to drop the hats on the A's and B's for simplicity of notation. And of course, the factor of alpha doesn't matter where you put it, so I can equivalently think of this as where alpha is an arbitrary scalar. Okay, the next property is linearity. So here we have, if we have A tensor B plus C tensor D acting on U tensor V, then this is equal to AU tensor BV plus CU tensor DV, where implicitly what I've done is assume that C is a linear operator on HA and D is a linear operator on HB. Now notice that where they act, which Hilbert space they act on, is implicit in the location of the operator relative to the tensor product symbol. So the fact that this is on the left-hand side of the tensor product symbol means that it's acting on HA. We also have linearity for the states. So here we have alpha psi 1 plus beta psi 2 tensor product with gamma phi 1 plus delta phi 2. We can re-express this as alpha gamma psi 1 cross phi 1 plus beta gamma psi 2 cross phi 1 plus alpha delta psi 1 cross phi 2 plus beta delta psi 2 cross phi 2. Now, just to get a sense of things, for how many of you is this either known or completely obvious? About 2/3? Okay. Okay, so they can capture the sideboards, so I'm going to use them. Now, for the dual space, we have, so how many do you want? I mean, I can do the pedantic mathematics here and say, okay, well, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are complex numbers, and psi 1 is an element of HA, and phi 1 is an element of HB, but I'll assume that's implicit. If anyone thinks this is unclear, just let me know or ask me after class. So here, if we take, so again, the left, if you're left of the tensor product, it means you're in HA. If you're to the right, it means you're in HB. And now we want to take the dual vector. So we're taking the adjoint of this vector to give us the dual vector. And then the only thing you have to remember here is that alpha is going to get complex conjugated. So this becomes alpha bar times the vector psi tensor phi, where psi is in the dual space. Sorry?
I mean, alpha is only, in the first expression, it seems as though alpha is multiplying only the first.
We got to move alpha out. It doesn't matter. I mean, alpha could move, the scalar can move freely. This is your one-dimensional Hilbert space, right? So this can move anywhere. It's completely, but the point is it has to be inside the bracket because it's getting daggered. So that's the key, because if you're going to be taking an inner product, you have to remember to complex conjugate any scalars. That's important when it's a relative phase, as you'll see later. And then we can have an inner product. So the inner product between, if I have psi 1 tensor phi 1, and I take an inner product of that with psi 2 tensor phi 2, then you just evaluate this by taking everything on the left of the tensor product symbol operates on itself, and similarly. So the point is, in mathematical language, psi 1 is a linear functional on HA. So it's going to act on a vector in HA, which is this guy. So that means this is equal to psi 1, psi 2 times phi 1, phi 2. OK, but this is just multiplication. OK, good. And this, I think, will become clearest in terms of the matrix representation. So here we say if psi is an element of HA, which we'll assume HA is C an M-dimensional Hilbert space as before, then psi can be represented with respect to an orthonormal basis so this means represented with respect to an orthonormal basis of our choosing. Psi takes the form of a column vector. Psi 1, okay, this is going to be bad notation, so let me fix it. Let's call it A1, A2, all the way down to AM, where A sub I is defined as the inner product of our basis element AI with the vector psi, where here AI is some orthonormal basis for CM. And then we can do the same for HB, and then we can look at what the matrix representation of the tensor product is.
Sorry, question. The way you've written down the inner product.
Hey, just one second. Yes?
The way you've written down the inner product, is that a definition? I mean, is it a way of defining what the inner product is, or it just happens to be like that? Because you end up with the multiplication on the second line. Yeah.
I'm not sure. You want to know if this is a definition or a property? Is that the question?
Yes.
Definition.
I mean definition in the sense that if you write down, if you say what a vector space is, then you say that addition must behave in a certain way, or addition must work out in a certain way, or scalar multiplication must work out. Is that the same way you're writing what the inner product is?
I think this is probably just an implied property. I don't know if it's an independent definition. I can't imagine it being any other way. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
Are you asking me like a Euclid's fifth axiom kind of question? Like, is this implied or do we have to define this?
That's what I'm asking.
It seemed
like the most natural way to write it down, but mm-hmm. I wanted to know if we required it to be like that for some reason, or we just happened to write it down that
way. No, it's implied because Taiwan cannot act on anything else other than something.
Yeah, that's clear, but then why is it just simply multiplying out the two inner products?
Why is it a multiplication of the inner products?
Because they're real numbers.
Well, because I guess the point is, you know, what does this mean, right? So this whole object, I mean, in a sense, it's defining our notation. So you can think of it that way. I mean, it's not, you know, there's lots of ways to denote these operations, and we're denoting them with this notation. So in some sense, we're defining the notation. But in another sense, just to maybe make this more plausible to you, we know that... this element is an element of the dual space, therefore it's a linear functional, which means when it acts on a vector of the space, it has to create a scalar. So we know that this right-hand side has to be a scalar.
Yeah.
And then this object here is essentially, we've defined this to be the linear functional acting on HA. So what does that mean? You have to find some vector in HA on the right-hand side and act on it with this guy. And then I guess the point that, so you accept that, and you accept that, but then you're asking, why do we multiply them together rather than, say, add them? Okay, yeah, so that I'd have to think about. This is so natural to me, it's hard for me to kind of find fault with it or find the justification, yeah?
We can't add them because they are basically from the space.
These are products that are not consistent. Maybe this is the only consistent.
Oh, I think I see the answer. I think I see it. Because remember the question asked at the back from the guy who wanted to add C1s to our Hilbert space. What's your name?
Tom.
Right? So here's another way to think about it. Okay? Here's why you can see why the multiplication is natural. If I act on psi 2 with psi 1, I'm getting a scalar. Right? So what this is going to give me is some quantity, let's just call it gamma. And then the right-hand side is going to be some other quantity, let's call it delta. So gamma and delta are elements of C1. Now C1 is just complex numbers, but it's also a one-dimensional Hilbert space. So I can write this with the tensor product of two one-dimensional Hilbert spaces. But the tensor product of two one-dimensional Hilbert spaces is itself a one-dimensional Hilbert space, right? Because C1 times C1 is equal to C1 times 1, as I showed you previously, which is, of course, just C1. So that tells you that this has to be a multiplication, essentially, I think. It seems to me, anyways. But I think it seems, I don't know if that's a rigorous justification, but I think it shows that this ends up then just being equal to regular multiplication, gamma times delta. I hope that helps. I don't know if I have a better answer. Yeah?
I think if you take two Hilbert spaces and tensor product them together, you wind up with another Hilbert space, and the question is, what inner product are you using? So if you take like a function space, then you're kind of free in defining your weight function, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this definition is required to ensure that you're not, that someone doesn't try to make a claim that I'm going to take two Hilbert spaces, tensor product them together, and then like get a new Hilbert space and then just forget about the weight function. But you could probably get a similar thing if you make a requirement that if psi 1 is orthogonal to psi, if like two
vectors are orthogonal in the inner product space, in either inner product space at the start, when you tense them together, they don't like lose that property. So I think that that would probably give you an equivalent thing, but you haven't stated that anywhere. So I think this might be, you know, it's probably, you need to probably put this in or put something else in. I don't think you have that already.
Okay, so let me just interrupt you and say that I think another way to think about this is, I'm holding two erasers. So the other way to think about this is, I don't know if Aggie gave you yet the those notes on, you know, the very, very careful discussion of what's a vector space, what's an inner product space, and all that. So there I actually gave like the axiomatic discussion of what defines an inner product, what properties does it have to satisfy. So now the fact that we already have an inner product defined on each Hilbert space, so the fact that we have a Hilbert space means we've already said this is what our inner product is. And now the composite Hilbert space has to satisfy those same properties. So I think looking at those formal axioms about the inner product space, and here we don't have to worry about completeness in the norm because this is finite dimensional, then you can see that probably the unique assignment of the inner product on the composite space is this rule. So I would challenge you to try and derive that from those careful definitions that Aggie passed out. And if you have any trouble with that, let me know, because I'm interested for my own satisfaction to see that that goes through. Yes?
Maybe we could think about an idea of having that product instead of the sum, for example, with orthogonality. Be like, yeah, phi 1 tensor product psi 1 acting on phi 2 tensor product phi 1. That should be zero, because they are.
That's a great point.
States.
Right.
Well, in an orthogonal basis, orthogonal states.
Mm-hmm.
But if we use the sum, it would not be zero.
That's a very good answer. Yeah. So think about this. So here's what's happening. Remember, if you just have one Hilbert space, if psi 1 is orthogonal to psi 2, then the inner product is zero. If phi 1 is orthogonal to phi 2, the inner product is zero. What that means for the composition is that if psi 1 is not orthogonal to psi 2, but phi 1 is orthogonal to phi 2, then that zero is going to make the whole thing orthogonal. So if you added them, you wouldn't get that because you would get a finite contribution from psi 1 and psi 2. So that might be another way to prove that this is the unique way to realize the inner product.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if you like require that, then you get that sort of
All right, so thank you. That's a good point. Okay, good. So I want to talk about matrix representations. And again, when we look at this in the matrix representation, then it'll be crystal clear because we'll be doing like, you know, third grade algebra. And and you'll see that this is all very natural. And I've heard people say that, you know, as long as you stick to finite dimensional quantum mechanics, the mathematics is no more complex than linear algebra. And that's a nice thing about quantum mechanics. That it's pretty much the most basic math you can get. But it turns out there are always subtleties that crop up. So I thought so there over there I defined the matrix representation. So now similarly, for some phi, which is an element of HB, we can construct a representation, which is going to be a column vector. And I'll denote this B1, B2, all the way up to Bn, where again, B sub L is just the inner product between BL and phi, which is some scalar. And here, BL is an orthonormal basis for HB. Okay, now we get to the interesting part. How do we look at the matrix representation of the vector of the joint Hilbert space? Well, we define some vector W, which is an element of HB. For simplicity, let's assume that W is equal to phi psi tensor phi, then we can compose a representation of W as a column vector with respect to a basis. And that column vector is going to have the following form. It's going to be A1B1, A1B2, A1BN, A2B1, A2B2, and so on, all the way down to AMBN, where, here, we can define W subscript, let's call it alpha, where alpha runs from 1 all the way to m times n. In each alpha corresponds to the index pair ij. And then the point is that, for example, AIBL, and this is just a regular product, is equal to the inner product AI tensor BL acting on, what do I call it, W? But W is equal to, in this case, psi tensor phi, so this is just equal to AI psi times, and this is your inner product, BL phi, which is, of course, just AI times BL, which is a scalar. Okay, now I've used the convention here. The convention is my ordering of my basis. Okay, so notice that, note, we have assumed a convention for ordering our basis elements. And the convention we've assumed is that the rightmost index varies most rapidly. Okay, so notice that the rightmost vector is phi. Phi is defined in terms of these coefficients b, and I'm allowing the rightmost factor to have the index varying more rapidly. I could have done it the other way, but this is the convention I use. It's probably the most common convention, but it's not universal. The point is, when you're doing a calculation, pick a convention and stick with it, and the final answer will come out right. And it doesn't matter what convention you use, you'll get the same answer, as long as you're consistent. Namely, here we're using that the rightmost factor varies most rapidly. Okay, but now we get into some interesting things. For example, we assumed here we were looking at a state of this form. Now let's do a little bit of a preview of entanglement. So recall that our orthonormal basis, recall that HAB is spanned I wanted to say, I didn't show this, but I'll leave this as an exercise. Think about evaluating inner product now. So if I have an element of the dual space in my matrix representation, what's that going to be? A row vector, exactly. So my dual space elements become row vectors. And so let me just remark, omega adjoint, which is equal to omega, if it's this vector, it's going to be a row vector, and what else is going to be different about it?
Entries are going to be complex.
Complex conjugate of the entries, right? So this is, we're going to have a row vector, a1, b1 bar, a1, b2 bar, et cetera. Okay, and now my inner product is just the algebraic inner product, which is a1, b1 bar, a1, b2 bar, times, well, in principle, this should be a different vector. So let me call it, gamma 1, delta 1, gamma 1, how about c1, d1, c1, d2. And now the inner product is just multiplying these elements in the usual way, which is going to give us some scalar. Which is going to give us some element of the complex field. And here you can see via the matrix representation now, that's exactly what this is doing. OK, so recall HAB is spanned by the orthonormal basis AIBL, where AI prime, BL prime, AIBL is equal to delta I prime, delta L prime. So now what this means is the most general vector in that space need not have this form. An arbitrary vector in HAB has the form, let's call it chi, equals a sum over I and L of, let's call it gamma IL, AI tensor BL. And in general, there does not exist, that's the right symbol for there does not exist, right? In general, there does not exist a pair psi comma phi such that chi is equal to psi tensor phi. All right? So the point is that certainly there are states of the composite Hilbert space which have the form psi tensor phi, but they are a very, very small minority. They're probably a set of measures 0 or something like that. In general, we have some linear combination of the basis states which defines a vector which cannot be expressed in this form. And let me just, instead of saying it like this, let me just say it's not equal to that for some psi and phi. Okay, so then if the state does not admit this kind of, if chi is not equal to the product of two states, where each belongs to the respective Hilbert spaces, then we say that the state is entangled. In this case, chi is called an entangled state. Whereas if we have a state W, which is equal to psi tensor phi for some psi and phi in the respective Hilbert spaces, this state is called a product state or unentangled. Okay. Now we will go into more detail about entanglement, structure of entanglement, and its consequences later. So this is just a little bit of a preview of it. And are there any questions about this structure? And I'll use the remaining 10 minutes to tell you about the classical analog of this. Yes?
Is this true for operators as well? Because earlier you wrote that there was an operator that was like a tensor B where each of those acted on an individual set.
Yes. You can construct an arbitrary operator as a linear combination of tensor products of operators. Oh, that's a good point. Okay, so this is a very good question, or an interesting issue. So you'll notice that the composite system structure we've just looked at, the tensor product structure for composite systems, I didn't elevate it into a fourth postulate. So the reason for that is that is the following. So first of all, as I've already noted, the structure I've given you in terms of the postulates isn't enough to go and describe some physical systems in the lab. And for example, this point is made in Asher Perez's book that I recommended to you, Concepts and Methods, Quantum Theory, Concepts and Methods. The point is there's a whole bunch of additional side information that we need to apply quantum theory to physical situations. So I told you that a preparation can be described by a vector in a Hilbert space, but which vector? What is the Hilbert space? The dynamics are described by a unitary operator, which solves the Schrodinger equation relative to some Hamiltonian. Well, which Hamiltonian do you use? So you need additional information to understand how to apply this mathematical formalism to a physical situation. So it should be clear already that you can't just run off with these three postulates and start, describing condensed matter physics experiments, okay? So the point is this additional information is necessary, and it specifies what are the physical interactions of the system, what are the physical procedures I use to prepare the system. Some of that information is relevant to this question that was asked earlier about if I have a eight-dimensional Hilbert space, a four-dimensional Hilbert space, how do I know if it's a tensor product of two-level systems, or is it just some pure four-level system, like an angular momentum, a spin three-halves particle? So a spin three-halves particle has a four-level structure, three-halves, one-half, minus a half, minus three-halves. And two spin-half particles have a four-level structure. But there, the natural indexing is in this composite space. So the point is, how do we even know that we have this tensor product structure? Well, the idea is that, look, you look at your physical system, there's some algebra associated with the operations you can perform on that system. And that algebra encodes the information about whether you're dealing with a spin three-half system or two spin-half systems. And when you look at that algebra and you ask, I know I'm working on a Hilbert space, what is the Hilbert space representation of this algebra, then the tensor product structure comes out naturally if you have two copies of SU2 versus one copy of SU4, which would be the three halves system. So the idea is that the tensor product structure is a consequence of the algebra describing the physical interactions that are available to you for that particular system. So that's my rationale. That said, this is actually a very subtle question, and I'm not 100% confident that that is a complete answer. So I'd invite you to think about it, and this is something that's not really discussed in the literature. And it's just, you know, I mean, you're basically getting to the point where in this class and your other classes, you'll be seeing things that are just open questions about how to understand the theories you're learning about. And this is one of them. And I mentioned earlier at the very motivation of this course, I said, we need the right conceptual picture for quantum mechanics. And part of one of the important questions in that pursuit is, what are the physical principles that imply the axioms of quantum mechanics? And I think that it's probably best answering a question like, is the tensor product structure a fourth postulate, or is it implied by the other physics you need to apply quantum mechanics? I think that would be clearest once we actually have a set of physical principles that we all accept as the right principles that imply quantum mechanics. So I think there's some interesting open questions there. And I mean, certainly it wouldn't hurt to elevate this to a fourth postulate. You could always find out later that it's unnecessary, but this is why I'm treating it the way I do. So thanks for reminding me to bring that up. Are there any questions about that? Yes?
Do you have, well, I mean, obviously there's some kind of relation between entanglement and bipartite, and whether or not a system is bipartite or not. If you're considering like a four level as opposed to two level systems. Do you, I mean, is there any kind of like definite words you can say about that, or is it just still all up in the air?
About what specifically?
About like the relationship between entanglement and whether or not systems are bipartite.
If you don't have a tensor product structure, you can't have entanglement.
Right.
It's only defined. Entanglement is always relative to a tensor product factorization. So for a spin 3/2 particle, it can't be entangled. It has no other degree of freedom to be entangled with. And okay, so this actually segues into the classical analog of this, which is the following. I was going to say one other thing too here. What was it? Oh, just remark. I think these can be complex. Maybe getting myself into trouble here. I think that, so here AL, of course, has to be self-adjoint operator. I guess if I restrict A and B to be not just linear operators, but self-adjoint operators, and if I want O to be self-adjoint, okay, so certainly if O is just a linear operator, and AL and BL are just linear operators, then we can allow this to be true. And it's not clear to me off the top of my head, if we restrict AL and BL to be not just linear operators, but self-adjoint operators, which of course have real spectrum, then, and I want O to be self-adjoint, then maybe CLs have to be restricted to the reals, but I'm not sure about that. I mean, it could be there's some special choices where the CLs are complex, AL and BL are self-adjoint, and O still ends up being self-adjoint. but I'm not sure about that. So anyways, as stated, we're just using linear operators. So just to answer that question that was asked, we can have some linear combination of AL and BL and define some operator O in that way. And if we want everything to be self-adjoint, then there's constraints on the coefficients, certainly. What those exactly those constraints are isn't obvious to me off the top of my head. Okay? Okay, so now the classical analog. Now, we're out of time.
We started late, so I can
just go late? All right. Okay, so coming between students and their lunch is not a good idea. All right, well, just for fun, I'll tell you my joke related to that. So I've used this joke when I'm assigned to give a talk at a conference right before lunch. I've used this joke. So basically, there was some study done, and they looked at judges. So they, you know, people go to jail, and then to get out of jail, they either serve their whole term or they can apply for parole. So parole is when you get out of jail early for whatever reason. And but this is something that's decided by a judge. So what judges will do is they'll have a whole day where they'll just like hear parole hearings from various, you know, criminals. And then they did a study to see what the rate of successful, what's the right term, way to put it, the success probability of the applicants for getting out on parole or being sent back to know you have to finish your term. And they looked at the success versus time of day. So this is like noon, and this is 5 p.m. And this is the success probability. And so the day starts at whatever, 9 a.m., and it goes like this. And then you have lunch, and they come back from lunch, and it goes like this. So this is, I guess, maybe some useful advice if any of you end up applying for parole, try and make sure your hearing is heard at 9 a.m. And I think it has a lot to do with how much food is in your stomach.
There's a similar strategy for like scheduling group meetings, isn't there?
Maybe there should be.
Before lunch, everybody's really cranky, but if you have an after lunch, everybody's in like the post-lunch kind of snooze mode.
Well, yeah, so, but then the question is, how much information are they? The judges may, the amount of sensitivity they have to the details might be like might be decreasing as well or something. Or
we had this increase. Similar thing going on like at certain exams in undergrad. Like people are trying to really schedule their exams after the lunch because the teachers were like very lazy and just like listening, then just like gave good marks and send the students.
Well, it's more important, you should make sure your exam gets marked at 1 p.m. rather than 5 p.m. when you just want to go home. Yeah. Zero. Don't. All right. So, all right, there we go. Some life advice for you. Now, so here you're going to be very probably unreceptive to this argument because you're all hungry. But I'll go for it anyways. So basically, the point is, I actually wrote some notes up on this. I could try and follow them. Okay. All right, so recall, so classically. Classical physics. Now, if I have some point in a phase space, call it x, which is an element of some phase space, let's just call it R2. So x describes my position, my momentum of a particle. So for example, x is equal to q, p, the physics and momentum of some particle in one dimension. And then I have another particle, y, which is an element of R2, and likewise, y describes the so this is system one, and this is system two. And then the key point here is that x and y are physical states. And now I want to describe both systems in the same mathematical framework. So then what I do is I assign some variable z to be x and y, and z is going to be an element of, all right, this is a bad example. Let's make this R3. Well, R3, what did I do with my notes? I didn't do this really, did I? All right, fine. Let's call it RM. And let's just forget about, well, this could be phase space, it could not be phase space. Forget the Q's, I'll just call them X's. So this is Y1, this is YN. Now the joint system is going to be an element of what? It's going to be an element of RM cross RN, where this is a Cartesian product. And one way to think about this, I heard one of the students in one of the previous lectures use the concept of degrees of freedom to think about something. That's a great way to think about things. Here the point is we have M degrees of freedom. Here we have N degrees of freedom. And now Z has how many degrees of freedom? M plus N, right? So the point is the Cartesian product really means that, here, I'm not going to move the board, I'll just erase. Here the point is then Z is an element of RM plus N. So this is very different from the tensor product structure, which makes it seem like the tensor product structure is really unique to quantum mechanics. But here, there's a false analogy here. We're comparing quantum mechanical states, which are vectors in a Hilbert space, and have a distinct operational meaning. We're comparing them to the physical states of classical systems. But physical states are not the only states of classical systems. Classical systems also have another state. They have a probabilistic state, okay? So let me say this is very different. This is very different from how we combine quantum systems. So now what I want you to do is open your minds to considering classical probability states. So of course, these aren't things that exist in the world, but they exist in our minds. They are objects that describe our information about the system. So for example, consider the following process. I have a M-sided die, okay? And I'm going to roll the die, and I'm going to get some outcome from 1 to M. Okay, so then that has some probability vector associated with it, with probability of outcome 1 all the way up to the probability of outcome m. So this is my information about the die, how it was manufactured and so on. So a uniformly random die is one for which p1 and pm are all equal to 1 over m. Of course, there's a constraint on probabilities of normalization. And of course, each PI has to be greater than or equal to 0. All right, now consider I have a second die. So let me use Q for this guy. So Q goes from Q1 to Qn, and this satisfies the same constraints, sum over I, Qi is equal to 1, and each Qi lies between 0 and 1. And these are the probabilities of each of the different n outcomes of this die roll. So now let me teach you a little bit about probability theory. So because of the constraints I gave you on the probability vector, we can remark the following. P is an element of Rm, and Q is an element of Rn. Right? And then consider M equals 3, then we have R3, which is regular three-dimensional space. But probabilities don't like live in our three-dimensional Euclidean space. It's an abstract space. And in fact, let me draw a better figure for you. Let me write more carefully too. Okay, so then we have this type of object. So here, this is the point 0, 0, 1. 0, 1, 0, and here this is 1, 0, 0. And then we have this essentially a triangle laying in the positive quadrant of R3. And probability vectors sit at points on this triangle. And this is called the 2 simplex. Or just the simplex, the probability simplex. It's the set of points in Rm where probabilities can exist. And because of the constraints, they have to be positive and sum to 1 and bound between 0 and 1. That means that the only points in R3 where the probability vector can live are these points. We have a similar constraint on quantum states. They live in Cm, the m-dimensional complex space. But normalization imposes a constraint which actually defines a sphere rather than a simplex. A hypersphere, I should say. So if you have, in general for Rm, this simplex is called the m minus 1 simplex. And it's called the 2 simplex because remember there's only 2 independent parameters. My probabilities have to add to 1, so once I specify p1 and p2, p3 is determined. So that's what this number refers to, is how many independent parameters do I have. Okay, so now the point is, How do we compose probability vectors? For joint events. Okay? Well, it turns out it's the tensor product. All right, so what you use implicitly when you describe the joint probability of 2 die rolls is the tensor product structure. But the notation is suppressed. You have to dig really deeply, in fact, to find any probability textbooks that even mention that what's going on there is a tensor product structure. Okay, so now let's define as W the joint probability vector, the probability vector describing the joint events. Joint events, for example, rolling both dice at once. Okay, well, what space does that live in? W is an element of Rm tensor Rn. And in fact, it lives in particular on the simplex, in particular on the Mn minus 1 simplex. And this, by the way, is just equal to Rm times n. Just like quantum states, except we have a real space instead of a complex space. So the upshot here is that it's not the tensor product structure of combining quantum systems that distinguishes quantum mechanics from classical physics. It's the fact that we're applying that tensor product structure at the level of amplitudes rather than the Born rule probabilities. Yes?
Yeah, because you got the Louisville form of classical mechanics where you do talk about everything in probabilities. Is that a similar?
Yeah, exactly. So I wrote my PhD thesis on that, by the way. In part. I mean, there was a lot in there, but that was one of them. And it was introducing the idea that if we think of quantum states as analogous to Liouville states, then we can understand there's a whole bunch of phenomena in quantum mechanics that are exactly reproduced by the classical theory, but that otherwise appear to be completely novel properties of quantum mechanics. When you think about the Hamiltonian picture of physical states, if you think about, so a Liouville state is the following. I have some physical system with some point in phase space, but I don't know exactly where it is. I just know probabilistically where it is. I have incomplete information about it. So I use a probability density function on that space to describe my knowledge about where the system is. And then it turns out that those probability density functions called Liouville states have a very, very long list of properties that are completely reproducing quantum mechanical effects. Quantum teleportation, no cloning, tensor product structure of composite systems, entanglement. There's a very, very long list of phenomena that are described by classical probability density theory and are mimicked by quantum mechanics. And so if we want to understand what's unique about quantum mechanics, we should look at its differences relative to that theory rather than relative to Hamiltonian physics. And of course, that point of view is suggested, the insight to even consider Liouville mechanics comes from being careful about how do we interpret the quantum state itself. Do we think about a quantum state as a physical object, or do we think of a quantum state as information? It represents our information about the physical object. And this is why I use the word described by a quantum state rather than is a quantum state in my postulates. Yeah.
Is an analogy of unentangled states in this case the events which are not related of the two dice?
Yeah, so I mean, the point is that if the two dice are independent, then my composite, my probability of outcome I and J, the probability of outcomes I and J is just equal to PI times QJ, right? And of course, these indices go over M times N possibilities. But suppose there are little magnets inside the dice, so that if I roll one die, it has no effect, because that only depends on its mass distribution. But if I roll both dice together, the magnets feel each other, and we get certain correlated outcomes in the dice. Then we can have joint probabilities which don't factorize. Mm-hmm. And that's analogous to entangled states. It's just classical correlations. Of course, entanglement is more than that, but we can understand a big part of entanglement from that. And the piece that's left over, that's the interesting part. Yeah?
When you talk about Liouville mechanics being quite analogous to Schrodinger mechanics, you're definitely correct. One of the big differences, I think, is it the time evolution behaves a bit differently in Liouville as opposed to Schrodinger mechanics? Or am I just making things up now?
Well, it depends how you do it. I mean, probably, I think I did this last year. Maybe I'll do this year. But there's this really beautiful formulation of quantum mechanics and classical mechanics in the same axiomatic structure due to Dirac. And there the idea is you write down one dynamical equation, which is essentially the Liouville equation or the von Neumann equation, and that has a Poisson bracket between the state, the density state, and the Hamiltonian. And then you say, okay, well now, let's just assume that's my dynamical equation. And I'll probably do this for you guys. This is just a preview. But then what's really cool is you say, okay, what's my algebra of observables? And if you say, look, I'm going to assume I have a non-commutative algebra, then there exists a unique representation of the Poisson bracket as the commutator, and you get the von Neumann equation, which is a generalization of the Schrodinger equation. If you assume it's a commutative algebra, then there exists a representation of the Poisson bracket as the differential operator d rho by dq, dh by dp minus, which you've all seen from classical mechanics, I hope. And then you get classical Liouville mechanics. And so the only difference is the commutativity or non-commutativity of the algebra of observables. And then you get both theories. So that's a really cool.
Okay, you better show us how that sounds awesome.
All right. All right, well, I'm standing between you and your lunch, so I think I'll let you go at this point. Thanks for your attention.